This is Luke Allison with CriticalBench.com, and I'm here with Eric Cressy. Eric, how are you?
Not too bad. How's it going, Luke?
Going good. I wanted to sort of get into your background. You have a reputation for working with baseball pitchers and being a bit of an expert. And I'm wondering, was this a specific goal, and sort of how did that come to be?
You know, it's actually interesting. My background, before that had been more actually dealing with basketball and soccer athletes when I was in grad school and kind of helping out with some of the teams at the University of Connecticut under Chris West. But after I finished my master's and I went to the private sector, it just so happened that some of the first athletes that I started working with were baseball guys. And with my own personal background of having a lot of shoulder issues, and I mean, I was a tennis player growing up, so I had a lot of kind of background with respect to overhead athletes, at least experience-wise, it was kind of a natural fit for me, and things just took off, and those guys got some good results, and really word of mouth blew it up, and here we are a few years later. But the funny thing about it is my mom always jokes that I was destined for training baseball players because I taught myself to read with baseball cards when I was little, because I recognized all the pro players, and all I had to do was match their faces up with the names on the card, and I, you know, kind of learned that way. So I guess, you know, part of it was subconscious, and part of it was very conscious.
It's an interesting, you know, story, because it never has, you know, the twist and turns that you would expect. You know, I don't know if we're at a point where someone can grow up and go, I want to work with baseball pitchers. I want to work with baseball pitchers. But
no, it doesn't work that way at all. I mean, especially in this industry where, you know, strength and conditioning as a field and a whole it's a very dynamic industry. It's constantly changing and constantly evolving. So, you know, if you're going to do that, you really got to know from day one what your true passion is, because that's what you kind of have to adhere to, and that's what you have to read on and stay on top of. So, no, I think a lot more people have to go through internships and go through experiences to realize what it is and what they don't want to do. I mean, I did internships in cardiac and pulmonary rehab when I was growing up, and, you know, it wasn't a good fit for me, but I need to have that experience in order to know. So it's
right.
A little tougher nowadays than when we all used to say we wanted to be astronauts or professional baseball players.
Sure. I wanted to get in a little bit of your experience sort of working with athletes from different sports. One of the things that I notice a lot is the amount of feedback from various sports is extremely different. Something like pitching, you have really sort of high quantitative, just off the charts in terms of feedback, whereas something like, you know, some of the positions in football or powerlifting, there's basically no feedback for
a
lot of time.
Yeah, it's entirely different. I mean, the thing about baseball that's you know, I mean, I've had professional players who have 20-inch vertical jumps who can throw 95 miles an hour. And it's the same reason why, you know, a lot of guys look at me and I may not be the most jacked guy in the gym or on the surface look like really that physically daunting, but I got a good deadlift. You know, it comes down to being very, very, neurally efficient with, you know, very specific motions. So just like you or I could get good at a deadlift or a bench press, some people get very, very efficient with their mechanics on the mound. You know, they may have very good hand-eye coordination and very efficient in rotational power at the plate. So that's where they're unique, in that a lot of times baseball players are very successful because of traits and not necessarily, you know, things that are really trainable. So a lot of times our training is more focused on how to allow them to make better use of those traits, how to manage them so that they don't get hurt. You know, if you look at the research on major league pitchers, actually major league players on the whole, about 89% of them have a positive sulcus sign in both their throwing and non-throwing shoulder. So what that tells you is those people have a very high amount of congenital laxity. They have a lot of freaky joint range of motion that allows them to throw baseball hard. You know, if you look at hand-eye coordination, you're not going to play professional baseball as a hitter unless you have, you know, at least 20/15 or more like 20/10 vision. So, you know, those are things that influence, you know, success in this sport that may not be governed by purely athleticism. So a lot more of what we, you know, sometimes have to do, unfortunately, is, you know, we're not necessarily dealing with freak athletes. What we're dealing with is very good tradesmen who need to learn how to stay successful in spite of the fact that they may be playing, you know, over 200 games a year between spring training and the regular season and postseason and all that.
I think you bring up some really sort of interesting things with vision and sort of joint, you know, laxity and whatnot. Can you tell the difference between something an athlete is interested in, whether that's a lift or a sport, versus something they have an actual aptitude for?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question. You know, I think that, and that's what, you know, professional baseball scouting all comes down to is, you know, how can you figure out who the best players are at the youngest ages and get them to the big leagues as quickly as possible? You know, that's how you win games. If you, you know, if you go back and look at the Boston Red Sox in 2007 when they won the World Series, I mean, they had, you know, probably 5 or 6 of the top 30 players in baseball under contract all combined for under $6 million. So they got their talent to the big leagues quickly. So that's partly development, but it's also very good amateur scouting and getting people in the right systems. So, no, I don't know that it's as easy as we might think because, you know, anyone who's trained young athletes has come to appreciate that everything changes around ages 14 and 15. You know, when a kid goes through puberty, he may be going from being completely unstable to being so stable that he's in fact immobile. So bodies change a lot when you're, you know, when your femur grows 2 inches in the course of a year and all these things dramatically change and you're kind of dealing with a new body. So, you know, really for us, kind of the telltale sign is most of our kids, sophomore / junior year of high school is when you can really start to tell, you know, who's going to really take to this, who's going to be a stud in their sport, and they kind of separate each other out. It's very, very interesting in the sense that, you know, our 2011 class, which are seniors, we have 21 kids in the class of 2011 who have committed to Division I baseball scholarships here at our facility
wow.
in Massachusetts. By that same token, right now we only have one in the class of 2012 who's given a verbal commitment. So it's just it's very, you know, early, and what's going to happen is over the next month, literally, we're going to find out, you know, which kids are going to come out of the woodwork and be really, really special, and, you know, which kids are going to need more time to develop and maybe not hit that level. So it's kind of an eye-opening experience when you see how quickly things change at that age and how big their windows of adaptation are.
Yeah, it's always been, you know, a bit of a mystery. I worked very briefly with players, and I was not entirely sure, you know, if they, you know, box squat and they're sort of rotating, you know, to their pitching side, and I'm like, what is this? And it's like, oh, he's a left-handed pitcher, and you're like, oh, okay.
It's pretty profound. One of the schools of thought we've started looking a lot more at, I got turned onto it by my buddy Neil, who works with the Diamondbacks. There's a school of thought called the Postural Restoration Institute, and it was actually founded by a dentist from Nebraska named Ron Horuska. And really what he looked at is, you know, our anatomy, you know, going all the way back to just, you know, seeing what cadavers look like. And when you think about it, we're always taught, you know, you have 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 arms, 2 legs, you know, we're built symmetrically, right? Well, what no one really talks about is, you know, we have a liver on the right side. We have a heart. We have a vena cava on the left side. You know, we have more prominent diaphragmatic attachments to the spine and a, you know, more prominent leaflet on the right side as well. You know, there's 2 lobes to one lung versus 3 in the other lung. So really we're not as symmetrical as you might think, and all these internal organs differences, you know, can actually be, you know, very, very apparent in the way that we carry ourselves. And I have an article coming out at T-Nation here pretty soon that touches on it a lot. But what we ultimately find out happens is a lot of these right-handed individuals who spend their entire life playing a right-handed dominant sport re-ingrain the natural asymmetry that we see on such a level that, you know, it becomes pathological. You know, so if you go into, like, any professional baseball clubhouse or even, like, Little League or high school or anything, look around at the number of right-handed players who have low right shoulders. I mean, you'll see kids that have, you know, a right shoulder that's a good, like, 2 inches below the left. And then you go around and you look at all the left-handed kids, and nobody has a low left shoulder. It's really a structural adaptation that starts with respiratory function and affects the orientation of the spine, the hips, the scapula, the ribcage, all of it. It's pretty powerful stuff. And, you know, we've done some, you know, a lot of before after pictures of the guys, and you can literally see how those asymmetries go down during the off season as they train to address them and they, you know, step away from their sport for a while. And you compare them to the, you know, the pictures after the next season, and you see a lot of this stuff comes back just because of their throwing volume. So it's always kind of just managing guys and keeping them away from threshold as best as you can.
It seems like throwing is something that's right on the verge of whether or not it's a good idea or not.
Oh, it's a terrible idea.
Okay.
I mean,
all right. Well,
you know,
I'll go with that then.
Yeah. It's the single fastest motion in all of sports. You're looking at over 7,000 degrees per second of internal rotation at the humerus. So if you take your humeral head, so the ball and the ball and socket that is your shoulder, that's 20 revolutions in a matter of a second. That's how fast things are going. So, you know, you take a shoulder that is moving at that high a speed, and, you know, you keep in mind that a lot of times that's a very lax shoulder as it is. You need so much dynamic stabilization from not only your rotator cuff, but also, you know, your scapular stabilizers, your lat, your core, your lower half. everything really has to sync up perfectly in order to just keep your arm from flying off your body, that it really is kind of an impressive, like, physiological, you know,
that it's possible that it doesn't just sort of separate from the body or something.
Exactly. I mean, and you don't have to look any further than some of the stuff that happens. I mean, you know, you look at the load on the UCL during every throw. I mean, you're at near failure load, so it really takes a combination of both, like, active restraints, so muscles and tendons, working hand in hand with, you know, passive restraints like ligaments, you know, your labrum, things like that that may not adapt to stress. And they have to line up perfectly.
There's an idea about, you know, obviously you just said pitching is, you know, not necessarily a tremendous idea, but there's also an idea right now in football that sort of slamming into each other thousands and thousands of times, you know, causes trauma to the brain, which essentially kills the brain. Are these sort of changes that you would see affecting who participates in what sport, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years?
I don't know that. Put it this way, I don't think we're ever going to take away from athletic participation, you know, just by scaring people. I think, you know, you're going to see more precautions in terms of, you know, protective equipment and things like that. But more than anything, what I'd like to see is I'd like to see people learning how to manage athletes better. We may not be able to control, you know, concussions and things like that as much as we'd like. But at the same time, you know, what we can control are the ACLs. We can control the Tommy Johns. We can control things like that that are very preventable with training. But, I mean, I trained Kevin Youkilis from the Boston Red Sox, and he actually gave a really good interview the other day where they asked him, like, you know, how are you feeling after, you know, he had thumb surgery last year? And he's like, I feel great right now, and that's all going to change tomorrow, because the second you get in season, literally what happens is, you know, you're never 100% until it's over again. So in a situation like that, it's going to, you know, you just have to appreciate that, you know, anything at the highest level of sports is not going to be inherently healthy. I mean, that's why these guys get, you know, paid a lot of money to play, is that they really are, you know, beating up on their body, and it's why you see guys who were retired wind up with arthritis. And, I mean, I think Terry Francona, who's the Red Sox coach right now, has had 32 knee surgeries in his life. So it goes to show you that, you know, these guys are really putting their body in the line all the time. So it's one thing for you or I to go in the gym and lift 4 days a week, but you got to remember, these guys might lift 4 days a week on top of hitting, throwing, sprinting, doing medicine ball stuff, taking ground balls, all that stuff, and it really does add up. And, you know, and over time it can beat you up.
Talk a little bit about the range of injuries that you're going to see from throwing.
The range of injuries?
Yeah.
It really, what everything comes down to in the context of throwing, if you want to sum up the overwhelming majority of injuries, it's really going to take place at the point where the arm goes from extreme external rotation, so like the end of the cocking phase, right where you transition to acceleration. So, you know, we call that the peel back mechanism at the shoulder. And what happens when you're all the way laid back, you know, your forearms parallel to the ground and you're getting ready to whip forward, essentially what you have going on is your biceps tendon is twisting and it's pulling off of the superior labrum. So in that, you can get irritation of the biceps tendon as it kind of slips in and out of the bicipital groove. You can get irritation, obviously, the superior labrum, because it can tug off. That's why a lot of guys have fraying and, you know, ultimately some guys wind up with tears. But in that same position, you can get what we call an internal impingement of the rotator cuff. So in a weight training population, we see more of a bursal-sided issue. So the top side of the rotator cuff gets irritated under the acromion process. In throwers, and, you know, swimmers, tennis players, all of them, we see more of an internal impingement. So it's actually a posterior impingement that happens way back in external rotation. And what happens is the undersurface of the rotator cuff gets irritated. So those are traditionally much tougher tears. They don't tend to heal very well because of the location and the poor blood supply. So at the shoulder, your big three are going to be biceps tendon, rotator cuff, and labrum. And, you know, a lot of guys have a little bit of each. I mean, 79% of major league pitchers have abnormal labral features. You know, there are really high numbers on partial thickness cuff tear as well. So, you know, you can have quite a bit of structural abnormalities on an MRI or on an X-ray, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be pathological. But that same instant, you know, can cause a lot of trouble with the elbow as well. So when you're laid back right there, it's a lot of what we call valgus stress on the elbow, and that can really wreak havoc with both the ulnar nerve, the ulnar collateral ligament. You know, you can get flexor or pronator strains. So really, medial elbow pain is your most common one. In a younger population, you can get some lateral pain, which is more of like a bony compressive type injury. But I mean, really, a lot of injuries do change over the course of the lifespan. You know, in younger kids, where the bone is the path of least resistance, you're going to see more growth plate injuries. As guys get older, you're going to see more ligament and soft tissue issues because those are the path of least resistance after the bones mature. So lots of stuff to consider.
Yeah, lots of different ways to sort of go about, you know, being unhealthy and whatnot. One thing I noticed, and I'm not sure if there's a pattern, this would be certainly more of your area, but noticing things that would be, you know, throwing injuries, labrum injuries, broken humerus, detached biceps, in athletes that do not throw.
Yep. Oh, I mean, you will certainly see it. You know, a lot of times you'll see it in like the guys who haven't done it for a long time, and then they go out and they decide they want to play beer league softball. But
sure.
Yeah, you will see some pretty crazy stuff. I mean, and you got to remember, like, if we're talking about like a labral tear, you know, there's certainly different kinds of labral tears. You'll see, you know, more anterior labral tears in a weightlifting population, whereas, you know, everything you see in throwers tends to be posterior, and if it is anterior, it's after a long time and it's migrated forward. But, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, the other thing you have to consider is, I mean, think about what's happened in Major League Baseball. I mean, they waste literally billions of dollars on players who are injured on the disabled list every year. And the question becomes, you know, why is that happening? Is it happening because they have terrible strength conditioning programs? Is it because players are lazy and out of shape? Is it because the nature of the sport is so demanding? No one ever points the finger at what I think the most obvious, you know, kind of rationale for it is, and that's because kids have been overused for years. You know, they've been beaten up in the younger ranks and, you know, thrown with poor mechanics and been, you know, insufficiently strong and flexible. And what's happened is, you know, they've just taken years and years and years to reach threshold. So we may see a 23-year-old kid who gets, you know, a Tommy John. In reality, he probably had a partial UCL tear when he was 14, and he just managed it and went in and out in physical therapy for years and just kept doing the same old stupid stuff over and over again. So a lot of times these issues just come, you know, they take time to reach threshold, but, you know, is it socially acceptable to do an elbow surgery on a 14-year-old? Probably not. At 23, is it okay? Yeah, absolutely. You know, kids mature, he can speak for himself, go ahead and
right.
do it. So I think, you know, the problem is a lot bigger than just what's going on in professional baseball. It has a lot to do with the AAU generation and how kids are managing themselves.
Is that something that you can manage specifically through, I guess, the finite, you know, facets of baseball? Can you put people on pitch counts? You know, can you have the state, you know, athletic association saying can only throw so many pitches, or can you change the way
they've worked
major league?
They've worked too. They, you know, USA Baseball has put out their pitch count recommendations,
yeah.
and the ASMI has put some good stuff out and all that. But, you know, my answer would be, you know, can you keep kids healthy? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know that I've been working heavily with baseball players since 2006, and knock on wood, we have never had a Tommy John on our watch. I mean, that's an incredibly powerful thing when you tell. I can tell you we have 85% of our clients as baseball players. I've rehabbed a ton of guys who have come after him, but we've never had anybody that's trained with us for an extended period of time have a Tommy John. And if you look at what goes on in terms of geography, people in warm weather climates tend to have lower injury counts than people in cold weather climates have lower injury counts than people in warm weather climates. So, you know, just being in a different environment, training differently, having a different appreciation for how to manage yourself within the competitive year, you begin to appreciate that, yeah, you really can prevent these injuries.
And that becomes ingrained, obviously. You know, then you have places to go and you learn that. And
I think so.
Become perpetuating. Okay.
And I think the biggest part of it is you make young athletes informed consumers. You know, they know how to take care of themselves. You know, they're not always going to be on my watch. You know, eventually some of our high school kids are going to get drafted, and they're going to be playing in rookie ball out in Montana by themselves. And, you know, I want to make sure that we've educated those kids so that when the day does come that they have to stand on their own 2 feet, you know, they're going to be in a position where it's going to be like a piece of cake. So it's tough.
One of the other things that you're sort of known for is, I guess, a treatise that you did on unstable surface training.
Yes.
Is that something that you can sort of summarize really quick for maybe someone that didn't come across the journal article.
Yeah, at the University of Connecticut, for my grad degree from 2003 to 2005, my master's thesis was basically the first ever long-term training intervention. So we had over 30 subjects for a matter of 10 weeks. And basically what we did is we effectively replaced about 2 to 3% of their training volume on stable services with unstable service training. So those were soccer players. And we pre and post tested them on, some plyometric measures, so a counter movement jump and a bounce drop jump. Test them on an agility measure, so a T test, and both a 10 and a 40 yard sprint. And what we basically were looking at is, what happens to strength and power when you replace even a small percentage of training volume, with this unstable service training. And really, what we were trying to do is we were trying to simulate what happens with in most programs when people do include, lunges onto the Bosu ball or single leg squats on a diamond disc or whatever it may be. So we went through all that, and the results were published in Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research back in August of 2007. And I delivered my thesis, probably about the April before that. And really, what was interesting is we found that, while these things may be very, very useful in ankle rehabilitation and all that, you got to be really, really careful about applying them in a healthy population, because you can look all the way back to the research in 1966. They showed in the research that proprioception is very, very, very skill specific, meaning just because you can stand well on a unstable surface, which is a lot of static balancing proficiency, does not necessarily mean that it's going to carry over to dynamic activities. So, for us, we our conclusions were we recommended that people use them in extreme moderation, if at all, in healthy athletes with no history of ankle sprain. And that's markedly different than what you're going to see in the real world nowadays. And I went on and I wrote like a 95 page ebook up on it and talked about different functional balance training strategies and all that. But it was pretty eye opening that even that small amount of unstable service training could have such a profound long term training consequence.
It just seemed necessary to point out, because you still see people on a stability ball or on a Bosu ball or on a disc, just
yep.
constantly.
Yep. We found out that the athletes that we tested, we did it during their spring soccer season, and we accounted for training experience, previous history, injury, all that stuff. And what we found was that all these guys were 97% the same with their programming, but what the big difference was this inclusion. We found that everybody improved on these measures. They got faster, they jumped higher, things like that. But the stable surface exclusively training group improved more. So what it did was it attenuated improvements in the unstable service group. And they can go online. It's on PubMed if they want to read it. It's if you go to unstableservicetraining.com, there's stuff up there as well. So there's definitely places to check it out.
There was sort of a corollary to that I wanted to ask you about, because I know you have a powerlifting background also. Certain people, certain styles of thought, certain training methods, you'll see people squat on the foam, or you'll see them board press off of foam.
Yeah.
Is that in any way the same, or is that completely different?
That's going to be totally different. I mean, when you're squatting to foam, it's a lot different. I mean, we're talking about, our study was exclusively looking at lower body unstable service training. So when the unstable implement was between the floor and the ground. So what you're talking about in those situations, you still are inherently stable at your points of contact with the ground. Likewise, if you look at the research, there also appears to be a difference in the way that we react between upper body and lower body unstable surface training. So a push-up on a Bosu ball may actually be a great exercise. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Most of the time our lower body works in closed chain motion, so our feet are on stable ground, whereas our upper body kind of works in a little bit of both. We get open and shown closed chain responsibilities in our daily lives. So I think that accounts for some of the difference, but we still use some unstable surface stuff in our upper body. We tend to stay away from it in the lower body, though.
It's as complicated as you want to make it. I think that's
that's
one of the things that you have to make it accessible for everybody. There's sort of an idea sort of out there, sort of floating around in the market that maybe not, you can sort of write your own programming and be your own expert. Is that something you think is possible, based on sort of limitations and bias?
I think it's possible, but it definitely takes time. I mean, I know for me personally, like, we have interns at our facility all the time, and, you know, I'm always blown away at how awful the programs they write are the first time that I actually take a look at them, and we go over and we start talking about how to do it. I usually give them a pretty serious programming challenge, and I set a deadline on time on how long they have to do it, and then we look over it and we talk about how, you know, they could be better with respect to the unique situations that I outlined. But, no, I think, put it this way, you know, there are people who have jumped in and become successful personal trainers over the course of time because they're self-educated and they never took a class on how to do this, but it definitely takes time. By that same token, I don't do my own taxes. If I need a contract, I would never, you know, write my own. I would go to a lawyer to have him do it. So I think the question is not just can it be done. I think the question is can it be done efficiently and done well? Because everybody can go and grab TurboTax and try to do their own, you know, taxes, and what do? They miss out on a bunch of important write-offs. You know, they miss out on, you know, something that's going to get them audited. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think you have to figure out whether it's really in your realm of expertise or whether your time is better spent elsewhere, especially if it means, you know, you're going to have markedly, you know, poorer results doing it on your own. So that's where it gets tricky. But, I mean, I try to self-educate people as much as I can, and, you know, that's some of the stuff I've done on my blog is just, you know, gradually teaching people how to, you know, understand that, you know, there are certain core principles that every program needs, and you're just going to tinker with those to make things right.
We live in sort of a strange, I guess, point in time where, you know, outside expertise is available, you know, through yourself, someone like Mike Robertson at IFAST. But it's totally unclear. You know, it's like I'm in high school, I have a strength and conditioning coach. I'm in college, I have a position coach and a strength coach. And there's a graduate kinesiology program here. Mm-hmm. Sort of where do you see the need for sort of outside help?
That's the million-dollar question. I think, you know, obviously anybody who's too busy to even give it the thought of their own. We have a lot of clients who want to just show up, do their thing, and get out of here. And I appreciate that. Like, you wouldn't believe it. It's no different than me wanting to just pay somebody to do my taxes. So I think that's an obvious one. I think the other, you know, situation is people who are coming off of injuries. That's an absolute no-no in terms of, you know, doing your own thing because, one, you know, an injury situation, you have unique physiological needs. You know, there are neurological changes. There are structural changes. You're fundamentally not the same as everyone else. So, you know, going to, you know, just trying to pull something together on your own is not necessarily going to be a good idea. You know, if you're a generally healthy guy, you have a fair amount of training experience, you haven't accumulated a bunch of issues, yeah, you can get away with, you know, experimenting, pulling some stuff together for yourself. But, you know, I find that those people are the ones that after the course of time, they realize that, you know, they're better off kind of referring out and, you know, deferring to people's expertise just because it gives them the variety they need and they get to experience, you know, different training styles and see what it is that works best for you. I think a lot of times when we write our own programs, we're more inclined to do what we're good at, not necessarily what we need.
Right. I think we all sort of fall into that from time to time. To go back to program design just for a little bit, is there anything that you have sort of really strong feelings about in terms of program design?
Oh, yikes. I mean, I could go on all day about it. You know, I think the biggest thing is, you know, that the people – I think most of the people I see are maybe your typical internet consumers. A lot of people really are convinced that they're more advanced than they really are. And I think people get, you know, too far away from the basics sometimes because they're convinced that they're physiologically different than someone else. I mean, a lot of times, you know, I'll take a poorly written program executed at 100% effort over something that's incredibly well thought out and then just executed at, you know, at subpar. You know, so I think a lot of people need to spend less time thinking about how special they are and more time just busting their ass and working harder. It's, you know, maybe it's a little bit short to say and all that, but, I mean, really that's the impression I get of a lot of people. You know, I'd say the one other thing that I see a lot of is people don't appreciate that sometimes the easiest way to get bigger is to build a good pool of strength beforehand. I know for me personally, I spent so much time, so many years trying to stay as a legit 165 in powerlifting that literally, like, in the 3 months after I decided I was done at 165, I ballooned up to, like, 192, and I've just kind of hovered there ever since. It was like my body knew exactly where it needed to be in light of the strength levels I had, and like, literally, I've hovered kind of at that weight class, you know, for another couple of years because my body kind of had this place where it wanted to go. So I think over a lot of people, they spend so much time trying to find these elaborate rep protocols and, you know, trying to creep weight up, you know, sometimes just get stronger. You know, I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I guess that brings in sort of different aspects of, self-discipline and where did you learn to work hard
Yep.
and things like that that don't have anything to do with program design. So,
Yep, absolutely.
I guess just to close up, I've taken up quite a bit of your time, but if
Oh,
people
no
are in sort of the Boston area or in their they're in New England, how do they find you? How do they get in touch with you?
Well, our website for the facility is cressyperformance.com. It's just Cressey performance.com. And my personal website is just ericcressey.com, Ericcressey. And we've got a, free daily blog and biweekly newsletter and all that stuff. So it's a good time, but there's lots of ways to get in touch with me. I'm pretty accessible.
Well, Eric, I appreciate the time. It certainly, little for action, a little scary, a little bit, but, certainly informative. I definitely appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
You too.